We're in the book of Esther. How many of you like the book of Esther? I mean, that's not a good... Of course you like it. It's in the Bible, right? How many of you have it as a favorite book? It's your favorite book in the whole Bible. She's not known by her real name. Esther is not a real name. That's a name. That's her Persian name. Her Jewish name is Hadassah. So you have to like that one, don't you, Patty? Patty's got a daughter named Hadassah. We're going to be in the first chapter. We got an introduction last time. We're going to be jumping into some of the things that take place here, just the setting of the book and the situation of the book and getting to it. Esther is a unique book in many ways. One, it's one of only two books in the Bible named after a woman. Also, Esther is unique among the books of the Bible because it's the only book in which God is never mentioned. How is it possible that we have a book in the Bible that God's name is not in? Not his name, nor a pronoun referring to him, nor a prayer, or anything religious, the Bible, the law, anything. None of these things are mentioned in the book of Esther. Esther is odd when you consider those things. How did it wind up in the Bible? Well, because if you read the book, you'll see God is all over the book. I mean, he's everywhere, but he's in the background, in the shadows. The book of Esther represents a time in Israel's history when Israel had disobeyed God terribly, and all the promises that God had made about the things that he would do to them based upon their disobedience had come true. And they were, it's not that they didn't believe in God and not that they had turned necessarily their back on God. In fact, they in every way were trying to get back to God, but they were afraid to even mention his name. He stood in the background for them. To mention his name was too painful, brought up too many painful and disturbing memories for them. And so it was more comfortable just to leave him out. And so God stands in the shadows, if you will, in the time of Esther, in the time of the exile of his children. He stands in the shadows, but he's not left them. He's not disowned them. He's not failed to protect them. He does not fail to provide for them. And many of us can relate to this book. In fact, probably all of us can, because all of us at one point in our life have had to have our lives directed from the shadows, haven't we? God was not in the front of us because we didn't want him there. But he was never anything but straight behind us, always with us, always caring for us. And our lives have been directed back to him because he doesn't fail us. He doesn't leave us, even though we probably deserved it. He does not leave us, and he did not leave his children, the children of Israel, either. He delivers in the book of Esther. Israel is basically, this is a story of God delivering the children of Israel from annihilation. That's what the book of Esther is all about. Yes, it's about a woman named Esther, but nonetheless, she is just an instrument or a tool that God uses to stop what would have been complete genocide. And I want us to make sure before we go any further, just again, introduction to the book of Esther, when we consider how God works, it's important that we realize the order in which he delivers, because we are all dependent upon his deliverance, are we not? So what is the order of God's deliverance? And why I say that is because typically when we think of God's deliverance, when we think of deliverance in general, we usually think of it in this order. Something happens, and then a rescuer or a deliverer or a savior arises in reaction to that something that has happened and delivers or rescues or saves or whatever they do, right? That's the order we typically think of it in. And while that is probably true in the human realm, in fact, no doubt it is true in the human realm, in God's realm, this is not true. Here's something I want us to get through, and it needs to take, it takes a long time for it to soak in, and so I'm not expecting you to get it all right now, but I want you to hear it. Hear it very carefully. This is a very deep theological point. God, listen, never reacts to any situation. Never. Never has, never will. He preempts every situation with omniscience. That's very few words, but it's really deep stuff. God never reacts to a situation. He preempts every situation with omniscience. To say God reacts to a situation implies, at least initially, that he didn't know it was coming. And that simply is not true. He preempts every situation with omniscience. Omniscience literally means that he knows everything. He never reacts. He preempts. So let me explain this way, a popular verse that we're familiar with. And by the way, Romans 8:28 is a great verse to have. If you want to write a verse, if you want to transpose a verse out of the New Testament into the Old Testament, a great place to put this verse is at the front of the book of Esther, because this is if you will, an illustration. It's a play that demonstrates how God does these things. Now, it was real life. It wasn't some play acting or anything like that. Don't get me wrong. But Romans 8:28 is explained by the book of Esther, how God takes the worst of things and turns them into wonderful things. But I want us to read this verse, and I want us to consider just a few things. We should be familiar with this verse, but I don't know if we interpret it correctly. Romans 8:28, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God. That was the children of Israel. To those who were called according to his purpose. I hope it's also true for you. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love God and those who are called according to his purpose, it says. Typically, we think of this simply means that God takes what comes and works it for good. Isn't that typically the way we interpret this? Because that's generally the way we see it. If we put my name up there, which it wouldn't be true, but if we did, Bill takes all things and calls them to work together for good, it would be a safe assumption to say, I'll call my secretary and say, what's on my list today? Or my wife. They're the only ones that have my list, by the way. And I don't have my list either. They direct them. Anyway. What's on my list today? What's on the agenda today? And I take it as it comes, you see. And do y'all hear that? Something's happening. And as it comes, I take it. And if I can turn these things into good, that would be an amazing thing, right? Well, God doesn't work the way if I could do this, which I cannot. God doesn't work the way we would work if that were our circumstances. God doesn't take them as they come. This is not so. Again, this assumes that God didn't see it coming. God is all-seeing. He is all-knowing. That means he's perfect in wisdom and perfect in knowledge. He doesn't just see things before they happen. Here's the theological deep stuff. Ready? He has always seen it. He doesn't just see it before it happens. I guess I could technically do that. I don't know how I could do that, but maybe there was a way for us to see it before it happens. I don't know how. You know, maybe some science fiction movie or something like that enables us to see, you know, jump ahead and see something before it actually happens. God doesn't just see it before it happens. He has always seen it. He doesn't just know something before it happens. He has always known it. This is what it means to be omniscient. It's not just that he knows everything. It also is that he's always known everything. Forever in the past, he's always known it. So how is it possible that he takes all things and works them together for good? Because, man, how can you overstate he saw it coming when he's always seen it? He's always known it. He doesn't work. Even if we could pull off something anywhere close to this, the chances of me seeing it in advance, maybe, that would be great. Or taking it as they come, that would be great. God is better than both of those things. He's always known. That's why he's good. That's why he can work all things together for good, because he's always known it. He's always seen it. He doesn't react to situations. A question would be, when is God planning? At what point does God plan work his plans for our rescue? He's always been working on his plans. At what point does God act on behalf of his own? He's always, listen, always been acting. Before your lifetime, before any of our life, before there was a world, he's been acting on behalf of those who he knows, who he foreknew, it says in the scriptures. He's always been acting. He's always been planning. God never reacts to the situation. He preempts every situation with omniscience. And just so we're clear, I think we're tempted in some cases to think that our salvation is a reaction. Adam and Eve sinned. Therefore, in reaction to their sin, God sent his son, Jesus Christ. Now, that doesn't sound bad theology, but it technically is. Because it assumes that God reacts to stuff that God didn't see it coming. I'm telling you, if we got a God that didn't see it coming, we got the wrong God. God, to be God, has to have always known. He's always known it. He's always seen it. In fact, the scriptures state it that way. We say that his salvation through his son is a reaction. No, it's not a reaction. Notice. 1 Timothy 1:9. He has saved us and called us to a holy life, not because of anything that we have done, but because of his own purpose and grace. This grace, notice, was given us in Christ Jesus before the beginning of time. That's pre-Adam Eve. That's pre-world. The whole plan of Jesus was before anything took place that needed Jesus. That's what you call preemption, for sure. And just a portion of a verse out of Revelation 13:8 says the same thing, basically. The Lamb who was slain, Jesus, notice, from the creation. I thought he was slain 2,000 years ago, and the creation is supposed to be 6,500, according to the Bible. But in the mind of God, it was a done deal. Before he created anything, before he decided anything, before he spoke anything into existence, he'd already decided it because he's always known. To be God means he can't learn anything. He can't have to wake up and say, what's on my schedule? Or what's coming today? That's not the way God's not like us, guys. He's always known. So in the story of Esther, you got this evil guy by the name of Haman. Plots to destroy all the Jews. And God's action to thwart it. So at what point does God begin to act? Not when Haman gets to power. Not when he puts out an edict to destroy all the Jews. When does God start acting? How old is Esther at the beginning of the book? Do you know? No one's for sure know. Guessing 20s, maybe late 20s, early 30s, something like that. When was she born? You know, he didn't just snap his fingers and say, oh, Haman's here. We need a good-looking woman to offset him. Is that how it worked? No. Haman comes to power. He's probably in his 30s as well. The king Xerxes is in his 30s. So arguably Esther's in her 30s. When was she born? 30 years before. There was no Haman. You follow me? Xerxes may be born, but he wasn't in power. His dad or his granddad was king at that time. There was no issues. There were no plots to destroy the Jews. And when was Esther born? See, God's, he's working in our lives, guys. He's already working on stuff that hadn't happened yet. And that's hard to wrap your mind around it. But to be God, that's the way he runs things. He doesn't just take things as they come. He doesn't just react to us. He doesn't react to anything because he's always known. He's always seen. You can trust him. May I suggest that to you? You can trust him because he knows. He's capable. He sees. You can rest in him. You can trust him. Prior to trouble, God is moving. Prior to need, God is providing. Esther is an example of that. The book of Esther is an example of that. So we have this book, and I want us to start reading here in verse 1. We're just going to read the background and this situation that brings about Esther is an unknown at this point, the beginning of this book. But she's going to be well known. It says, now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is not a name, it's a title. Every single king of Persia got the title of Ahasuerus, just like every single king of Egypt got the title of Pharaoh. They had a different name, but this is their title. So it sort of clouds who this guy is, but most believe this guy to be Xerxes. Xerxes, the husband of Esther, who was more or less the final king, final major king, at least, of the Persian Empire. Ahasuerus. It says, Ahasuerus, who reigned over India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, over 3 million square miles, this guy reigns over. Known world. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, which is all the way over in Iran today, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed his riches and his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180, otherwise known as 6 months. He throws a 6-month party. Spends a bunch of money. King Ahasuerus, you need to know who this guy is. He's important because he's a major player in this book. Otherwise known as, I think, like I said, most believe his name is Xerxes. Roughly 35 years old. Raised in luxury. His dad was king. He became king. He was not elected. He's not a politician. Now, well, I would love to not have a politician. Okay, well, then you get one of these guys. He's egotistical. Rules, like I said, the majority of the known world. He's spoiled. Thinks he's God. His people think he's God. He rules, basically, he runs the place with a status as if he were God. And he gives himself, by the way, one of the titles he gives himself is King of Kings. In one sense, he is. I mean, he's over all the kings known. He's over them. But in another sense, he's not the real King of Kings, is he? You know, we don't have anybody like that today, do we? And we look in the past and we say, oh, wow, they were really weird back then. I mean, people who think they're God, we don't have people that think they're God today, do we? Let me put some interesting things that have come out of our culture just here in the United States in the past 40, 50 years, more recent, some of them. Here's one by one famous guy, no longer with us. Christianity will go, he said. It will vanish and shrink. We're more popular than Jesus now. The famous quote from John Lennon, who's been dead. I guess if he was God, God's been dead for 35 years. I think he died in 79, didn't he? 80? What was it? Gone. We don't have anybody who thinks they're God, do we? I won't be happy until I'm famous as God, gives herself the name Madonna, which is otherwise known as the title of the mother of Jesus, by the way. She gives herself that name very, very intentionally. I guess she's not going to be happy. I don't know what to do for her. Here's someone else, not necessarily saying she's God, but notice how big a heart she has. Whenever I watch TV and see those poor starving kids all over the world, I can't help but cry. I mean, I'd love to be that skinny, but without all the flies and death and stuff. Such a sweetheart, you know. It just breaks my heart, too, that she can't be that skinny. Wow. I mean, we look at this guy who's spending jillions of dollars, and he's got people in his kingdom dying, genocides going on in different places. Horrible circumstances. Does he care? Nah. We haven't changed, though. We're still producing these kind of people. We can be these kind of people. Here's my favorite guy. My greatest pain in life is that I will never be able to see myself perform live, Kanye West. I share his pain. What a guy. Where do we get these people? Well, society produces them. We have the tendencies within all of us. We have a tendency to all think that we're God, given the right set of circumstances and the right set of sense, I guess you could say. And so as far back, you're looking at 2,500 years here in the time of Esther. And we look back and say, oh, well, they were weird back then. Guys, nothing's changed. We're still people, the same kind of people with the same tendencies. Technology has changed, but people have not changed. Given the right set of circumstances, we're the same. We're no different. We're no better. And so this Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, decides to throw this major party according to his own magnitude. Most believe the reason why he threw this party, by the way, estimated 15 to 20,000 attendants for 6 months. Most people believe, historians believe, the reason why he threw this party was to sell war. He wanted to make as if 3 million square miles was not big enough. He wanted to move further west. They owned everything basically from India down to Ethiopia and over into Turkey, the majority of Turkey. He wanted to move off of Turkey, cross the Dardanelles, and go into what we know today is Europe, beginning with Greece, and at the top of Greece, Macedonia. And so he's selling war in order to make sure, because that's a major move west. And so you're going to have to bring a lot of people and do a lot of things and spend a ton of money and watch a lot of people die. And so he's selling war to his generals and to his leaders and all this stuff. By the way, this war is his demise. He crosses Turkey and tries to cross the Dardanelles, and he meets the son of Philip of Macedon, otherwise known as Alexander. We call him Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great was a kid, but he winds up destroying Xerxes' army and taking over all of Xerxes' kingdom in unbelievable speed. Nonetheless, this is where he is, and so he's selling this war. Estimated attendance, 15,000. He houses these people. He feeds these people. He parties these people for 6 months. Guess who pays the bill? The taxpayers. They had taxpayers back then. Nothing's changed, guys. You think our government lives large today? Let me tell you something. They could learn a few things from old Ahasuerus. He knew how to use taxpayer money. He called it his money, by the way, of course, but he got it from the people. He just got as much as he wanted. How many needy people were there in his kingdom that day? Those 6 months. How many need financial assistance? He doesn't use it to create infrastructure or jobs, does he? Sound familiar? Interesting, isn't it? We don't have to shut our eyes and imagine what this could possibly be like. He doesn't use the money to improve. So what does he do when the party's over? Well, notice verse 5. He throws another party. 6 month party. What do you do after a 6 month party besides check yourself into rehab? You throw another party, that's what you do, because you're the king. And when these days were completed, it says the king gave a banquet and lasting 7 days for all the capital. So we started with 15,000, and now the whole capital, which is 50 to 60,000 people, come for 7 straight days. And it says, the people were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least, the court of the garden, the king's palace. They were all brought into the palace, and they all had this huge party 7 straight days. And it says there were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple, linen of silver rings and marble columns, couches of gold, solid gold, silver. I mean, you just got so much of it, right? What are we going to do with this stuff? I don't know. Let's make a couch, right? Let's make a chair. Let's make a footstool out of it. Silver on mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble, mother of pearl, precious stone. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. That is, there was no compulsion. In other words, you weren't made to drink, but notice you weren't made to stop. For so the king had given orders to each of his officials and household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So his wife is off entertaining the ladies, and he's in with the men, and they are just literally having all they can possibly handle. So 7 days of just out and out, total drinking, blowing yourself out. What do you think happened? No limit on money and no limit on booze. What happened? You know, people get liquored up and go do random acts of kindness, don't they? Isn't that right? Isn't that the way you start a sentence of before something really good happens? You know, they got to drinking and they went out and did a bunch of good stuff. Is that the way it goes? What happened here? Do we have to conjecture what happened here? Can we imagine it? What would it be like to live in a culture with such excess? Again, we don't have to shut our eyes and imagine it, guys. This is going on in our culture. Maybe bigger than he did. Think about it just for a second, just as an example, and there's many other examples we could use, but just our Oscars and our Emmys. People arrive in cars worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, dressed in dresses of thousands of dollars, wearing jewelry worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And people get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to take their pictures and to stand there with a microphone and talk about these people who mean nothing in the scheme of things, truly. But the reason why they're getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to hold a microphone or write something about them is because we love these people. They're getting paid this kind of money because we like to watch. We want to hear, don't we? Yeah, we do. And they stand up there, and they are absolutely loving all the pictures and attention they're getting. I mean, who doesn't love to be worshipped, right? And then after the thing is over, then the after parties and the receptions and the gift baskets and all these things, and they, whoever it is, drop millions and millions and millions one night. And the world is full of people who could use that money. I mean, the money used in that one night could fund several third world countries. You know, one of the biggest complaints that I hear from people who question the existence of God is they say because there are starving people in the world. Needy people, if there is a God, why does he allow why doesn't he supply for starving people? You know what my answer is? It's not a question of supply. There's plenty. The best I can tell, there is enough to feed the world several times over. The question is not supply. The question is distribution. Plenty, more than 200% worth of supply, 90% goes to 1% in the world. That's where we are, guys. We don't have to shut our eyes and imagine someday, oh, back in the day when Esther was living and Ahasuerus and man, they lived an opulent, excessive lifestyle, and almost as if we can't imagine it, guys. Like I said, come on, really. We know what this is like. We can imagine it. We don't have to scratch our heads and wonder about the, I mean, think about just, and since I've already got my soapbox up here, think about the enigma, as we call it, of the spiraling down of our education system. Why is it going downhill? And if you think for just a second, we pay our entertainers, and by entertainers I mean our football players, our basketball, and our baseball players, millions just to sign a name on a dotted line, just to sign. Bonuses. And how much do we pay our teachers? There's your enigma, guys. That's the enigma right there. So they drink unlimited, unrestrained for 7 straight days. And the effects, I mean, how many people died? How many fistfights? How many rapes? How many unwanted pregnancies? How much decadence and depravity took place in those 7 days? I mean, the society, it's just the way it was, right? And again, do we need to shut our eyes and imagine what this could possibly be like living here on South Padre Island when we get 7 days bigger than this? 50,000 here. 50,000 would be a low number for us during spring break, wouldn't it? I'd be like, horrible. What happened, right? And what happens here? How many people die here? I think we had 6 last year. But I'm only trying to point out the obvious, just simply to say, guys, this is, as much as this may seem to be removed from us, it's not. We live here. We know this. We understand this culture, this society to a degree. Oh, they were Persians and they lived in Iraq and Iran, but they're just like us. They're no different than us. Western culture didn't invent excess. Didn't invent opulence. It's been around for a very long time. We're no different. I mean, they could have done this yesterday, and it would have been no different than the experiences we have today. We would have not raised a single eyebrow because we understand this. We've seen it. So the question is, the idea is that we live in this godless culture. We understand it, don't we? That loves pleasure and makes gods out of people. We know it. We know Esther and her uncle or her cousin's situation, Mordecai. Trying to live a life in a culture that is going totally against God. Doesn't consider God. Now, it may very well be on their lips, but it's not in their actions. It's not evidence in the way they do things, the way they handle their money, the way they consider things. It's not there. Simply not. We know what it's like to try to live for God and for His priorities in such a place as this. Not hard to place ourselves here, but we need to do that. And we also know how hard it is to see God working in such a place. Imagine yourself in the situation with Mordecai, with Esther, and wondering where God is and could God possibly do anything. And we sit back today, 2,500 years later, looking at their situation and say, boy, if they had only see what, they could only see what we see. We know their story, don't we? Look how wonderful God did things. Look how great things were. And, look how well God, things turned out. Look how incredibly preemptive God was in taking care of these horrible circumstances that came about. Completely godless culture. No way to see God in the midst of it. Yet they should have seen Him, shouldn't they? They should have known. We sit here today on this side, if you will, of problems, or maybe the thing that happens tomorrow or the next day, unable to see or understand what could possibly happen. But guys, we need to know something. God's working. There's no way they could have said, oh, Esther's going to take care of it. She's the girl. I mean, look how pretty she is. God's raised her up, born 30 years ago. She's going to deliver us. There's no way they could have seen that. But if they had, would they have been wrong? See, I'm not saying that we need to look around and figure out exactly what God's doing, but what we need to do is say, God can be trusted. We live in a very decadent society, a depraved society, worldly, pagan. But God is moving. He may be in the shadows, but it doesn't matter. God is moving. God supplies before there's a need. God begins working on issues before there's ever an issue. I want to close just with a story that I found touching to me, and I hope you will find it touching as well. Just an example of how God works. The story comes out of Africa about 100 years ago. mission work there. Mission teams were living there. Missionaries were living there out of England. And they were dependent upon supply for their needs and for their goods out of England. But the stuff came by ship, and it came once a month, once every 2 months. And they had an orphanage, and they had a little mission, and they were working down in the southern part of Africa. And one of the ladies that was a part of their mission had a baby prematurely. And, of course, premature today is a tough thing. Premature in 100 years ago was really a tough thing. Premature in Africa 100 years ago, oh, man, hardly a chance for that child. Due to complications of the delivery, the woman passed away, leaving a 4-year-old daughter and a 1-day-old daughter. And they had no incubators. They needed something. The only thing they could come up with is if someone could possibly find a water bottle, and they could heat some water up and put a hot water bottle in and have sort of an incubator in with this baby. But all the water bottles they found had holes in them. And so the one of the missionaries went in to one of the children during the day school that they had there, and he told them the situation. Of course, they knew the mom, and they knew the child, and they heard about the baby that had been born and everything. And he told the kids that they needed to pray. We need to pray, he says, for these two little girls. They are without their mom, and this one is probably going to die because she's been born early and she's not in good health. And so a little girl in the back raised her hand and said, "Can I pray, Pastor?" And he said, "Yes, you can pray." Little girl stood up and prayed an astonishing prayer, almost scary prayer, because it was so specific. She said, "Dear Lord, I pray that today you would send a water bottle." He knew how incredibly impossible that was. I mean, they were in the bush in the middle of nowhere. "I pray today, God, that you would send a water bottle today," the little girl said. "Not tomorrow," she said, "because the baby won't make it. But today, God, so that the baby will live. And I pray," she said, "Lord, I pray that you would send a doll for her older sister because she's now without her mom and she's going to be really sad and lonely." And the missionary said, was telling the story, said it was scary because it's just like, man, when you get that specific, it's kind of like either he does or he doesn't show up kind of thing. It's just real. But whether he does or doesn't, you're going to know. It's not one of these, "Oh, God bless them, help them feel better" prayers. It's very specific. He said that day, one of our bundles arrived from England. Like I said, we didn't know when they were going to ever come. They would come in by donkey or camel or something to us from the coast. It arrived that day, this bundle, and he says there was tons of stuff from different churches in England that had sent to us. He said, but among those things, he said, guess what we found? We found one water bottle and one baby doll. He said, we looked at the mark on the post when it was sent. It had been sent 50 days prior. He said, man, I learned a big lesson about God that day. He said, there was a part of me when that little girl prayed that wanted to shut her prayer off. He said, I just thought, if it doesn't happen, look at all these kids, they're going to turn away from God because God didn't answer their prayers. He said, I was scared of the faith of this child. He said, I learned a big lesson that day. God in the darkest times, in the most difficult times, provides. He's there. He sees. I want to ask, if you would, bow your heads and close your eyes with me, and I want you to look over your own circumstances and situations. I don't know what you're experiencing. Don't know what you're going through. But I do know this. I know that God is not reacting to whatever you're going through. I know that He's never reacted to anything. I know that He's preempting it with omniscience. He doesn't just see it beforehand. He's always seen it. He's always known it. You can trust Him. You may not be able to see today what He's doing. You may not be able to see how His hand is moving and the things that He's working, but you can know this. He does work all things together for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. Maybe all you need to do today as you sit there contemplating whatever that is, whatever those things are, that you need to turn your heart toward God today and just simply say, God, I trust You. God, I trust You. God, I intentionally rest in You today. Because You're a God who's bigger than circumstances, bigger than happenstances. You don't just take things as they come. Oh, You've always known. God, we thank You that You are that God. A God not only who sees, but who is always seen. not only who knows, but who is always known. You've always been working for our deliverance. You've always been taking things into hand and taking care of them, God. We give you the honor for who you really are. Thank you, God. We thank you for the story of Esther, to see that in the midst of pagan situation, you're working, standing in the shadows. Most don't even know you're there. Doesn't matter. You're working. You're moving. God, I pray as your people, whether we can see what you're doing or not, we would still, with the eyes of faith, say, God, thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing. We don't know what it is, but God, we thank you. God, we give you glory. God, we trust you today. Thank you so much, God, for hearing us, for being with us and speaking to us. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.